From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll meet a computer scientist who works to make technology, specifically artificial intelligence, not only more available, but more inclusive and ethical.
Then, in her first months in office, Wisconsin Tourism Secretary Sarah Meany has tried to think like a first-time visitor to the state.
I've really wanted to encourage the entire team in the department, but also everyone in the entire tourism industry, to be as curious as a visitor within our own state, because it really is our job to think like a visitor in order to tell the stories in a way that makes sense to people who are less familiar.
And the joys of writing noir fiction using Milwaukee as the city that never sleeps.
They're not bad people, but they make bad choices or they have bad habits, and noir is great for that. So that's what I was looking for, is how do I show a protagonist who's a good person, who means to do right, but just messes everything up.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Most of us think of technology as a neutral force. Objects or processes are designed and implemented to solve problems, and there are no biases, implied or overt, at work. But our next guest says, not so fast. Technology cannot be neutral. What gets made, who makes it and uses it, and why is dependent upon our societies. And all societies are biased.
Sabelo Mishlambi is a computer scientist and researcher whose work focuses on artificial intelligence and the intersection of ethics, technology, and human rights. He was in Milwaukee last month to speak at UWM, and he joined us then to talk about the kind of issues that he's working on.
So a problem that we're experiencing today with internet technology is that it's being used to break apart the foundations of society, so social cohesion and the harmony that exists within a society. We now have technology that is being used to spread misinformation, to spread hate, and to spread false news, and to essentially control the content that people see, watch, and view. And when a company has the ability to control what people view, essentially they have the ability to influence their worldviews. So now people can be misled, and it's actually a risk to our social structures and our processes of democracy.
So how do you use your expertise as a computer scientist to fight that?
Right. So there's a big consumption with artificial intelligence. And the first misconception is that it's actually intelligent or it's smart. Computers are not thinking at any moment. They're just repeating. They're just following a series of steps and instructions. And so we have sort of taken this attitude that computers are impartial, they're not biased, they're just performing simple mathematical operations, and therefore we can use them to solve social issues. But this is really throwing technology to social issues, and it never works. So now we have technology replicating the social biases that exist, the inequality, the power imbalances that exist within a society.
I was going to say, and amplifying it.
Amplifying it,
yeah.
So essentially you have powerful, massive systems that are now being used to automate inequality and to optimize it, to even make it even more efficient. And this is something which we haven't been looking into because the public and some of people in our industry, we have assumed that these are simple mathematical models. They cannot be biased, right? How can a mathematical model be even racist, for example? But they're actually replicating the patterns that they observe in society.
And so this is the brave new world that a lot of people, you know, 50 years ago were afraid of, that somehow that this would end up being this essentially neutral tool, what should be a neutral tool, gets used in nefarious ways.
Right. Definitely. It's not a neutral tool because even the process of creating artificial intelligence requires engineers to build models to solve problems that they have identified. And so you're essentially creating tools to solve problems that fit your worldview, what you think needs to change, the worldview you have in mind. And if your worldview is not informed, if it's not inclusive, if other people are not involved in the process of building technology, of the leadership decisions being made on what to build, and even the funding, who gets the funding to build some of these projects. So now you have the embedding of biases within technology. And this happens by prioritizing what features to build, the time spent, the capital spent. These are all value-based decisions. And so it's not neutral in any way. One, it's not neutral mathematically. It's just replicating replicating patterns that exist. And secondly, when we build technology, we're building technology based on our own experiences and solving the problems that matter to us. So therefore, embedding our own biases and values into these products.
So is there a way to mitigate against that? How do we take this technology that we can't help but build in our own biases and correct for it, or at least become aware of it in the building process, right, so that we can change it?
Right. So definitely for my research, I think that what we have is a value problem, values problem. And the idea there is that our values are already misaligned. And so there are several key areas or key critiques of algorithmic technology. The first one is exclusion, which is the idea that we don't include people in the process of building technology. And so how we can solve that is if we're building tools that will be used on another community, we need to work with the community and determine what will the effect of these tools be on the community. So we need to include community members, digital rights groups, and so forth in each step of the development. And this will also help fix our biases because we can expand our worldview and have a more inclusive and more representative worldview. Another thing we have to take into account is the structural inequality that does exist. So unless the technology we build intentionally challenges these power inequalities, it's most likely going to perpetuate them. It's going to automate them. So are we intentionally designing technology to be corrective, to sort of have equity as part of the design in restoring, in sort of reducing these power inequalities that exist? Another issue is that there are several issues. When we build AI systems, the business models themselves are very problematic. And so they're based on the commodification of personal data. Essentially, this is the commodification of our digital selves, and that's exploitation. And so in order to commodify, and commodification is essentially creating systems that are driven by ads, advertisement. And so in order to advertise to us, companies have to learn about us. They have to know whom we're talking to, whom we're texting, whom we're calling, at what time, what we do online, how long we stay on a website, what we click, what we watch, and where we go. So every part of our lives is being collected and stored online. And these systems are trained on this data to learn more about us in order to sell and recommend more advertisements to us. So we need to sort of challenge this business model, because in order to commodify to us, now we have to be surveilled even more. And so now we have privacy invasions, privacy issues. So it's like a negative feedback loop that's really destructive.
Are we a little too far down the road now? Is there any way back from that kind of privacy invasion and the idea that our every online move is mapped?
So I personally think that we're not too far. I think the public has to get involved. There's some talk that we might have to have regulation. So maybe we could treat some of these public platforms as sort of public utilities and try to regulate them in some way. The key issue with that is that, you know, we have these powerful online platforms, and they're sort of like too big to fail in a way. So now we have private entities that have so much power with little accountability. And so when we see the effects of technology breaking, not just even here in the United States with the 2016 elections and how Twitter and Facebook were used to sort of influence how people voted or what they were thinking, but we see how technology breaks when it's designed here, especially in the Western world, and deployed to other parts of the world. For example, when Facebook is used to spread misinformation and hate in Myanmar, which facilitates genocide. We've seen that happening in Sri Lanka and in Nigeria as well, where hate speech will be spread on the platform, but there's not enough work being done to sort of filter the content. What we did notice, though, is that at the height of ISIS, platforms got together to find a way to filter extremist content. But we haven't seen the same effort, for example, with white supremacist extremist content as well. We can think of the recent shootings which took place in New Zealand. And recently there was an article where Twitter supposedly decided not to pursue this approach of filtering white supremacist content, because in that process they might sort of filter out some Republican senators. So it's really, you know, it's a problem that is not being fully addressed, but it can if the public gets more involved and becomes more aware of the negative consequences that could happen if this technology is not controlled and regulated in some meaningful way.
I know in Europe, Germany in particular, I'm thinking of, they are very, very cognizant of privacy, and they don't use social media in the same way. They hold themselves very much a part of that. And I don't know if that is because of just a cultural thing or if it's actually governmental, you
right.
know. But there are, you know, Western countries that seem to be way more aware of how this is being used than we do. It's still sort of a Wild West here.
Yeah. Germany and other countries in Europe are quite stronger when it comes to digital privacy. Recently, Europe passed the GDPR, which is sort of a legal framework for protecting user data. And so now companies have to sort of seek consent in order to collect your data. And there's more of an explicit awareness made to the consumers about, you know, the data being collected and even where the data is stored, how it can be moved, and how it's housed. So we find that the European Union has sort of a stronger view on privacy, whereas in the US, we don't have strong privacy regulations. And that's because a lot of these tech companies are from the US, right? So, you know, there might have been this attitude of, well, you know, let's allow some leeway in order for these companies to grow. And that way, you know, it could benefit the economy or, you know, somehow extend American influence, technical influence and technical priority. So with the privacy concerns, another third player is China. And so China has been seen sort of as this closed off state where there are privacy invasions that are happening at such a large scale. And due to the population, now the idea seems to be that if we don't support U.S. companies, then Chinese companies will take over. And so it's sort of like, now let's support these companies despite, you know, despite the flaws that they may have, it's better than having, for example, the Chinese take over. So, you know, we're not at a place where we have strong privacy regulations here in the United States, and even worse in the global south, in developing countries, where it's hard to have any meaningful type of data privacy laws. So right now, Europe is sort of the shining light on how digital privacy could look like.
You talk about the global south and developing countries. And one of the things I was reading about that you were working on is peer-to-peer networks that actually don't rely on the internet at all.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping you'll talk about that a little bit, because that fascinated me, the idea of being able to leverage the technology without having to tap into what is now the global internet.
Right. So this technology allows people to create sort of a private network. So it's a mini internet, if you can say, which relies purely on Bluetooth and Wi-Fi technology. And so this allows people to sort of form networks that are completely offline and mesh networks. So a mesh network is sort of a network where if I want to send a message to someone else, someone probably at the other end of a city, for example, I can bounce my message from one device to another. And this is how the internet sort of works, right? So if we're here and we want to send a message on Facebook, from your computer, the message goes to maybe another computer, maybe a few miles down the road, or then it goes to another server, maybe somewhere in Wisconsin, and then eventually goes to a server in New York, right? So it's going from computer to computer to computer. And so the software that I created is completely open source, so it's free and it's available. And it also follows the same model where now you can send messages from one device to another until it reaches the recipient. And essentially treating a phone as a computer. And there are other ways to do so. You can use sound, ultrasonic sound. And so now I can encode data into sound waves that the human ear cannot sense and hear. So there are various ways to work offline, which is also useful when the internet is being shut down, which is something that we've seen in the global south, especially during the times of elections, where oppressive governments may try to limit communication and how information spreads. And so this is a way for communities to still be able to talk to each other in a way that cannot be disrupted, because it's not centralized as the internet. It's actually distributed. And so there's no one switch you can turn off to then block the communication that happens.
And it sounds also like if you and I had one of these offline connections, we would have to have made that connection somehow, you know, both of us downloading the software, both of
yes.
us creating it, you know, so that I know I want to talk to you outside of the internet. So somebody who's not already in the system can't just jump in.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. So you have to at least one person has to have an internet at any moment. So what I've noticed in, for example, in the African continent, you do find apps that allow you to share data or files or applications just by using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi direct. So once someone has the app on their phone, now they're able to share it to another person using offline technology that that already exists. And so you can then now spread it in such a way so it virally spreads and grows, reaching even people that are remote.
And so the idea behind this, of course, is to allow people to communicate when oppressive governments might not allow it. I have to say there's also the downside of that where you might get an ISIS-like group who is trying to foment exactly the kind of hate speech and all of the kinds of things we were talking about on the internet. What prevents this kind of peer-to-peer technology from becoming another internet?
Yeah, that's a very powerful point. Nothing prevents it from becoming like that. For example, WhatsApp is sort of a tool that's used to communicate securely through encryption. So there's no way for a company to know the contents of your message, but they can know whom you're sending it to, but not the contents. And so we've seen how in Brazil, in the recent elections, WhatsApp has been used to sort of spread misinformation and to, spread hateful speech and try to influence the electoral process. And in India, this has also taken place. And so a tool that can be used for good can also be used for bad at the same time. What WhatsApp tried to do to resolve this was to limit how many people you can send a message to at any moment. So before it used to be, I can't remember the number exactly, but now it's been reduced drastically to only 5 people at a time. So it's not what curbs how fast messages spread, but it's not a complete solution. But I think this really speaks to the idea that we can't solve social issues by throwing technology at the problem. So ultimately, we have to look at the underlying social issues and try to address those, because technology can be used to perpetuate the social issues. And that the only way to prevent technology to perpetuate the social issues is to begin to meaningfully address the social issues. However, people in my community tend to believe that it's better to have this technology available and open, in the sense that what it can do for democracy is much more important than how it could be misused to spread misinformation.
It's better to have more openness than less.
Yes, that's essentially the idea driving the technology that's being created around encryption and offline networks.
As we're sitting here talking, I'm thinking it still comes down to the human being.
Yeah.
It still comes down to us.
Yeah.
And how we choose to use it and how we choose to approach the
right
world. I mean, technology can only do so much.
It can only do so much. And technology will only replicate who we are. So our social interactions that happen will still occur online anyways. So there's nothing magical about technology where somehow it brings neutrality or brings equality and equity. We have to intentionally, as we design technology, think of equity and think of how do we reduce some of the harms that can be facilitated through technology. It's really a human issue, but at the same time, it's not to suggest that we stop producing technology altogether and simply focus on the human element. But it's just we have to be aware and we have to realize that technology won't really solve all our problems. It could help in some ways, but if we're not taking into account that technology, especially artificial intelligence, it's meant to replicate these issues that exist in society and put them into digital society, if I can call it that.
Exactly. It's just like holding up the mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really mirrored to who we are. And when we speak of mathematical models, right, we're trying to match models to patterns that exist in society. And so you know that the model works when it's able to replicate the patterns in society. Now, if those patterns are coming from biases and inequality and the model is able to replicate them, we essentially have now, you know, automated inequality.
I was going to say, we've just amplified the problem.
Yeah. You know, it's something that's going to take a lot of participation from the industry. We have to be aware that we're causing this problem. And some practitioners might feel, sort of attacked, because most people, when they make technology, they're not trying to sort of cause harm, right? everyone has good intentions when creating some of these tools. It's to make the world a better place and to, you know, solve a problem. But we have to critically think of what are we solving and how are we solving it and whom is it affecting and who will be using that technology. So even fixing the apparent biases, it may not even go far enough. Because once we fix those technologies, how will they be used now, right? On whom will they be used?
Right, the unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there are many, and we need to include sociologists into this practice, philosophers, ethicists, and we need to include the entire human community. It's not fair that a group of people get to decide the technology that's going to be used for the rest of the world, for the rest of humanity, right? So, and it's a small percentage of people creating technology. So we need to allow people from the humanities to be actively involved and to be meaningfully involved the way we're being informed on what we're building and what the potential consequences will be like. So we have to really take a deeper look and begin to have more meaningful inclusion and allow different communities to be represented and different disciplines to be represented as we build technology that will be used by the rest of humanity.
Everyone needs to come to the table.
Exactly. Everyone. Exactly. Everyone deserves to be at the table as well.
Sabelo Mashlambi is a computer scientist and researcher whose work focuses on the ethical implications of technology in the developing world. He's currently a technology and human rights fellow at Harvard, and he was in Milwaukee last month to speak at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. There is more information about Mashlambi and his work at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Wisconsin Tourism Secretary Sarah Meany tries to get into the mind of a first-time visitor to Wisconsin. We'll learn how she goes about that work when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. When new Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes went to get their picture taken for the state's official highway map, they didn't go into a studio and they didn't pose in front of the state capitol in Madison. Instead, they traveled to a spot in Milwaukee where a lot of pictures get taken.
There is an official selfie stand on the edge of Lake Michigan in Lakeshore State Park. You can rest your camera on it and snap a photo with the Milwaukee skyline in the background. While it's not the only reason people visit the park, it holds a lot of appeal and a lot of cameras for tourists. So it makes sense that with summer travel season heating up, we would meet Wisconsin Tourism Secretary Sarah Meany at a bench across from the selfie stand to get an update on her work luring more visitors here. Well, Secretary Sarah Meany, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Always a pleasure, Mitch.
So we first chatted with you in this position not long after you got it, but in the time since you have become secretary, one of the things that has changed is you are creating a position especially about outdoor recreation. What's the need for that? What niche does that fill that has heretofore not been filled?
Right. Well, yes. And that is an exciting advancement. So in the process of, you know, working with the governor and him putting forth a budget and then the Joint Finance Committee, basically, you know, liking what they're seeing as it relates to the outdoor recreation, the Office of Outdoor Recreation, that is a new opportunity. So in conjunction with consultation along with the DNR and the opportunity based on the data and research that we have, we know that outdoor recreation is the number one reported reason people come to the state of Wisconsin. Now, some might say, well, okay, then why do we need to do something else if it's already working? And in reality, things are really strong, and that is what a lot of our tourism is based on. But that is a reflection of what can happen even without intentional and collective action. So what we know is that other states before us have taken the initiative to pull together an industry-wide effort to connect the dots between members of the industry, the outdoor recreation industry. So that includes both public and private, local, volunteer groups, nonprofit groups, and really identifying opportunities for everyone to work together, not stopping doing what they're doing, but instead finding ways to collectively put their effort toward major initiatives and further establish the strength of the industry to ensure that it remains sustainable and also remains successful.
So when you look at other states that have done something like this, what's been the upshot of what they've been able to accomplish through that kind of an initiative?
Well, so Colorado and Utah are two of the earliest examples of that, and it's a handful of years since they established an Office of Outdoor Recreation in those states. What they have seen, and the numbers in Colorado are really interesting, they're seeing double-digit and sometimes doubling of visitation and utilization of outdoor recreation facilities, whether that's visitation in general to the state in order to make that happen, or utilization of their natural resources and parks and trails. But also they're seeing an uptick in the number of businesses in the outdoor recreation space that are relocating to the state of Colorado, and creation of jobs and talent coming to Colorado for jobs related to outdoor recreation. So what it is it's a full economic lift. It isn't simply about a vacation or a visitor or a one-time pop. It's about long-term growth and sustainability for an industry that is already driving a significant piece of our economy here in the state of Wisconsin.
It's only been a few months, but do you feel like you have already been able to start, you know, sort of leaving your mark on the way tourism is done at a state level here?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, sometimes it's, you know, your head is down, focused on getting work done and setting strategy, and you have to take a moment and kind of look up and see what's around you. The good news is the work we've been doing to put in place a strategic plan for the statewide tourism industry is well underway, and we're only a few weeks away from having a final agency level strategic plan. Now, what does that mean? That means we are setting a plan with input and collaboration and
input
participation.
From who and collaboration?
Over 1,000 participants in the tourism industry from across the state gave us feedback on what they think is most important for the Department of Tourism to focus on. Some of the themes that bubbled up to the top are they're really seeking the department to lead in not just brand and marketing, but also lead in what it means to be Wisconsin, you know, create Wisconsin as a destination. So that piece of it was loud and clear. There's a lot of agreement that outdoor recreation is important and continues to be important in all 72 counties in the state. So that is something that has resonated, and people want to see additional guidance and support for that. And then additionally, people are looking for more resources and training and tools. Many are also asking for more data and research and access to that. That costs money, and a lot of the smaller regions and smaller destinations can't necessarily buy into that on their own. So that's a piece of leadership as well. So the good news is that piece of it is already making a difference. We're seeing a lot of shared goals. We're setting a vision that people are really excited about. And then that can guide us to the next place where we can take the state and attract more visitors in the future.
The place where we are sitting right now, Lakeshore State Park, is where the governor and the lieutenant governor had their official picture taken for the state maps of Wisconsin. What is symbolic about the place that we're sitting?
So if you're not from the Milwaukee area, sometimes it's easy to forget that we have this beautiful Great Lake butting right up against, you know, the skyline of our city. And Lakeshore State Park was created not that long ago to really bring back what was once here, which is, you know, native grasslands and native wetlands, and also the wildlife that used to roam here. So what we're experiencing here is people biking and walking and hiking and right here along the lakeshore. And it's a good reminder that even when we see urban development and growth, and you might even hear in the background some of the cranes and the construction that's going on, you know, what we have is where we came from and where we're going all in the same place. And that's really exciting. And Lakeshore State Park is just one of so many in the state where the outdoors takes precedent, and it reminds us that this is something that we have to take care of. The lake is something that we have to take care of, and our natural environment, along with our built environment, are what makes Wisconsin a wonderful place to live and visit.
How does what your department is charged with dovetail with the work of other agencies, most notably the DNR?
So the DNR and I, Secretary Preston Cole and I, have had many conversations and are very much on the exact same page that the work that we do overlaps and connects and uplifts one another's work. The same is true of the Department of Transportation, for example, and DATCAP, you know, with agriculture and trade and consumer protection. So we're finding ways to work across government agencies for the sake of efficiency and, you know, cost benefit across, but also in the sense that we're here to serve the state and the best interests of the state. And by working with the DNR really closely, while what they specialize in is caring for the lands and caring for, you know, wildlife and natural resources, it's our job to ensure that we can continue driving the economic impact of what makes this state great and what makes the state trails and parks and, natural environment such a wonderful piece of the attraction of the state.
As the budget process moves forward, how comfortable are you with what you are most likely to get in terms of resources to be able to do what it is you do?
I'm really optimistic about the fact that the Joint Finance Committee sees tourism as an important place to invest. Without a doubt, the data and past history tells a strong story that when you invest $1 in state tourism promotion, you see $7 in tax revenue in return. And there's without question that is a great place to invest. So for the first time in many, many years, seeing an increased investment and a belief in the plans that we're putting forth, I think is a really positive indication that the budget for tourism is going to continue to support our work. That's not to say, though, of course, that the competition, it gets tougher every year. We are outspent by many, many states, including some of our closest neighbors. And that makes it tough when we compete directly for many of the same people and the audiences, including our own residents. So we have to remain competitive. We have to continue to find ways to fund our efforts and to, you know, get our message out to a larger audience.
Do you think it is Michigan that sent the fog our way today?
I know the folks over in Michigan at Michigan Tourism quite well, and they're really, really good people. I admire the work they're doing. I hope they aren't blowing the wind in our direction just to spite us. But at the same time, we share something so important. It is this lake. And we work very closely with many other Great Lakes states to attract international visitors. So, and not long from now, in fact, the Cruise the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes Summit of Governors and Premiers is being hosted in here in Milwaukee as well. And that's an important indicator that it isn't just us. It's, you know, the many states and provinces of Canada that border the Great Lakes. We all have to work together, and we can all benefit from increased awareness, but also caring for our freshwater resources.
So I feel like the last time we talked, you had just gotten, did you drive a snowcat, I think it was? I'm just curious what some of the other things you've gotten to do as you have traveled the state in your capacity have been in just recent weeks and months.
So aside from all the amazing people I get to meet and work with every day, some of the coolest things about this job are the things I get to experience. Yes, I had just driven a snowmobile trail groomer. Which is a really large tractor, basically, with a huge sled behind it, which was a lot of fun. And I got to drive a snowmobile and do all those types of things. I also had an opportunity to ride a hydro bike on the Mississippi River, which is basically a one-person pontoon boat that is, you know, powered by a bike that pedals it down the water. And since then, the governor really liked that idea, too. And I think he's gotten one for himself and his wife. So it's a really cool mode of water transportation and exercise.
Take it out on Lake Monona? Or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or other places. Who knows where the governor goes out on the water, right? So that's a lot of fun. But I'm heading up to Ashland in a couple of days. I'm going to hopefully check out Madeline Island, and I'd love to check out the Apostle Islands and, you know, kayak. So really it's about being hands-on and understanding what it is to live the life of the visitor so that we can do a great job promoting that as well. And I've really wanted to encourage the entire team in the department, but also everyone in the entire tourism industry to be as curious as a visitor within our own state, because it really is our job to think like a visitor and think like a traveler in order to position and tell the stories in a way that makes sense to people who are less familiar. So it has everything to do with stepping out of your own bubble and opening your eyes and being curious to the things around you.
Not a bad gig.
I think it's pretty great.
Well, Secretary Ceramini, thank you so much. Best of luck in your work, and next time I talk to you, I'll be coming back as a visitor.
Thanks, Mitch. I hope you come back and tell all your friends about how great Wisconsin is.
Ceramini is the Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We caught up with her on a sunny and foggy day at the Lakeshore State Park in Milwaukee.
You can see a photo of our vantage point and the selfie stand we mentioned at WUWM.com.
But did you get a selfie?
Yes, but you will also have to go to WUWM.com to see it.
We'll take one last break, and then we'll talk with several of the writers featured in the new short story collection, Milwaukee Noir. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Noir exposes the underbelly of a place. In film or fiction, characters live in the shadows, denizens of a night where every good intention is punished. Noir found its natural home in New York City and L.A. in the 1940s and 1950s, but now Milwaukee can lay claim to its own piece of the genre.
Milwaukee Noir is a collection of 14 short stories edited by our next guest, Tim Hennessy. Two of the writers, Jennifer Morales and Valerie Lakin, joined Tim in the studio as well as he explains how the project began.
About 3 years ago, a friend of mine, Scott Phillips, was editing the St. Louis Noir anthology, and he had been in town and we met for coffee, and we were talking about projects that he was working on, and he had asked what I was working on, and at that time really nothing was working, and he had said, oh, they're looking to do a Milwaukee one, I could mention you. And I thought, oh, that's amazing, but why would they possibly consider me? I do book reviews and I do interviews, and I also am a bookseller, and my short fiction wasn't really kind of finding a home, so it seemed like a little bit of an unlikely matching to me, but he did reach out, and they were very interested, but their slate was full at the time, so I did mostly researching for a year, finding different authors I thought would lend themselves well to the project, and I wanted to incorporate a lot of different voices, so I was looking at journalists, I was looking at poets, I was looking at really anyone who could lend a really authentic sense of Milwaukee and what it's like to live here.
And it had to be new work, right?
Yes, all of it had to be first-time published work, and that was part of the challenge.
Okay, and how did you meet these two?
I was big fans of their work. I found both their books while working at Half Price Books, and it was just a matter of, you know, sometimes you're either getting a book in or you're shelving it and you think, oh, wow. And well, then seeing a Milwaukee connection, they definitely were people I looked deeper into their work and really fell in love with it. So they were, you know, right away people I wanted to have involved.
Now, Jennifer, once you heard about it, did you want to do this? Or was there any resistance?
I have a policy to, if I'm physically capable of saying yes, I will say yes. That is my, you know, my message to the universe. If I get a writing invitation, I will try to say yes. I am not a noir writer by nature. I'm a happy ending, can't we all get along kind of person. So the idea of writing a story, and I'm thinking noir is like, you know, Raymond Chandler and the, you know, the gritty private investigator, mysterious dame walks into his office and he's, you know, polishing off a bottle of whiskey, you know.
I just think Humphrey Bogart, you know, when
yeah.
I hear noir, that's what I think.
Yeah. And you know, so I wanted to be open to that. But I had to set some rules for myself about how I would approach this new genre. But I definitely wanted to say yes, so I did. And my two rules were I was going to write queer noir. I was going to bring in some kind of gay or trans theme into it. And the other one was no guns. And I often write about children. And so somebody suggested, well, you could have a water gun fight. You know, that would be fun, a little squirt gun thing. So I did work that in. But then the story really demanded a gun. So there is a gun.
But so you broke one of your rules.
I broke one of my rules. But that's part of learning to write a new genre.
And Valerie, had you any experience with noir writing before this?
Not exactly, although my first novel did have a crime element. So, I mean, it wasn't something that was completely alien to me, but I guess I would have thought of myself as more of a sort of literary fiction writer. And I didn't have that much experience even reading noir. So the first thing I did when Tim contacted me was I just went out and bought some of those noirs from other cities, like Boston Noir, New York Noir, that sort of thing. And I thought, well, I could try that, and I thought it would be fun. The good news was that also Tim contacted us in the summer, I think, and I teach during the academic year, and so I'm always more inclined to say yes to things in the summer. I'm like, oh, sure, I have all summer. This will only take a weekend or so. I can write that story in 2 days.
Was that true?
No, I worked on it for like 6 months. I finished it like a day before the deadline in
December or January, I can't remember. But there was one little kernel of an idea that I had been kicking around for a short story before Tim contacted me. And so when he contacted me, I thought, well, I could use that kernel for this story. And the kernel was that there's a manhole in the middle of my garage. And I've always wondered what it leads to and why it's there and what's down there. It's always kind of scared me a little bit. Every time I get out of my car, I step on it and it makes that rattly sound. And so my story ended up kind of following what happens down that manhole.
Tim, did you think of noir and Milwaukee together easily?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Why? What is it about Milwaukee and its environs that lends itself to the noir genre so well?
We have such a rich history, and it's always amazed me and fascinated me. And we have the socioeconomical conditions where there's so much conflict. Everywhere there is conflict in the city. I used to be a cable guy, so all day long I was traveling throughout neighborhoods throughout the city and the suburbs, so I constantly got to be in a lot of places and a lot of homes no one ever had access to. And you'd be inserted into conflicts and situations that a lot of times you're walking into the middle of a family during a crisis and they just happen to be getting cable. And so getting to see a lot of different neighborhoods really opened my eyes to the possibilities of just location. And certainly in my own work, I was always trying to figure out how to insert different aspects of different areas I'd see or different backgrounds and different economic classes. And there was never a lack of opportunity. And we have such a distinct culture here that I think goes ignored too often. And we don't often find anything in the city really or even the state represented in fiction that much. So that was something I was really excited to do. And certainly, I mean, we've got a lot of history of problems that keep rising up again and again. So that's always something thematic that crime fiction really draws on, is just how you kind of can't escape the past so much. Something bad happened in the past, and it sometimes can have reverberations to the future.
Well, often do. Yeah. You know, the idea that it just plays out into generations. I probably should have started with this question. What does noir mean to the two of you, the two writers? I mean, Tim's kind of described it for himself, but the two writers who are representing all of the rest of the writers in the book, Jennifer, what is noir?
I think it's darkness. I think it's about finding the underside of daily life. You know, I did go back. I did my research. I do my homework. I'm a good student. So, you know, I did go and read some Raymond Chandler. I read Patricia Highsmith. You know, I'm trying to go to the roots of the genre. And it feels to me that any story can be noir if you're looking at the underside of it, the shadow side, the dark side. And I'm really, really interested in complicated characters who are they're not bad people, but they make bad choices or they have bad habits. And noir is great for that. So that's what I was looking for, is how do I show a protagonist who's a good person, who means to do right, but just messes everything up.
I was going to say, the thing I love about noir is that no one is perfect. You know,
right.
There's no perfection here. It's like everyone has something.
Yeah, the baseline assumption is that things are going to go wrong, that people commit crimes, that people are violent, right? In normal, I think in non-noir fiction, the assumption is these are more or less regular people and some bad things will happen to them. I think the assumption in noir is many of these people are bad. If you turn over a leaf, there will be something bad underneath it. Like the assumptions get reversed, right? The bad stuff, the crime, the violence, the darkness is assumed as a baseline. So there may be pockets of goodness buried in there, but I think that it's like the underworld.
Right. It's almost dystopian.
Mm-hmm.
In its outlook on life, there are these sparks of little brightness, but they get extinguished pretty quickly, you know?
And there's like a bigger tolerance for things like melodrama and like sleaziness, sexiness, cynical attitudes that I think kind of make it really fun to engage with both as a reader and as a writer.
Was it fun for the two of you to jump into this as writers?
Yeah, it was great fun, because I now am talking with Tim about possibly doing a workshop at some point called Writing Dark, because it did change how I'm looking at my non-noir fiction.
anytime I learn something new about how to write is very exciting for me.
I was going to say, in a good way? Did it change it in a good way?
Yeah. It really opened me up to, like, no, your characters are tough. They can handle a little more sleazy, sexy, whatever Valerie does, and the beautiful alliteration, you know, violence. I can hurt them more.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the resilience ends up showing more dimension, and the conflict just kind of really escalates things too, because in a lot of noir fiction or just in crime fiction in general, you know, bad things happen and then they get worse, and you can, there's a lot of tone range that you can take that. You can, you know, there's certainly a lot of comic noirs that use and comic crime stuff that really kind of just exaggerate those features, and then certainly the more dramatic ones that really just build on that and just bring the characters into a much worse spot than they started off.
I was going to say, and both of you kind of are in that latter. These stories are both in that latter category. And I'm hoping maybe each of you would read just a little bit. I don't want to give away each story. I want people to come and read them. But Jennifer, you said you wanted to include queer and LGBT themes in yours. How did you do that?
Well, I feel like this story has two protagonists. I don't know if that's allowed in fiction. Maybe not. But there is the main character, Marta. She's our point of view character, is a gay Mexican-American woman from the South Side. Her cousin, who is known as Carlisa, joins the military, goes off to Afghanistan with the army, and comes back and announces to the family that she would like to be known as Carlos now, and addressed as he. And so that was the way that I brought in tension that I feel in the Latino community around gay and trans identities.
And it brings a certain extra darkness to the story that you're telling because of these layers,
It does. Yeah. I like that layering of the precariousness of their lives, that it's not just that they're threatened by the outside world, but even within their family, there's a struggle to accept this evolving person.
Is there a paragraph that you would share with us?
I can read a little bit from Marta talking to her mom on the phone and trying to get her mom to use the right pronoun for Carlos. Carlos has disappeared, so Marta is looking for him. I called my mom from the street outside. Have you seen Carlos? She made the humming noise she always did before she lied or held something back. Today? No, mi amor, not since yesterday. Yesterday? When did you see him yesterday? More humming. Well, she went to talk to her mom and... You should say he, mommy. Well, they had a little talk and then I don't know where she went. That's it? You have no idea where he is now? An icy feeling rushed down my spine. My mom could be evasive for a lot of reasons, politeness, shyness with strangers, fear. She did it all the time, but this felt different. You could ask your tía. I'll do that. So throughout the story, Marta's trying to be the ambassador and say, we need to accept Carlos for who he is and how he wants to be addressed. And as the story progresses, the family unfortunately continues to fail to get the message. And Marta misses the message in her own ways, too.
Yes. Yeah, she's, again, we talk about that there's no perfection. She's not a perfect character either.
Right.
Even though she's well-meaning.
Yeah.
So, Valerie, you have a very different setup. It takes place on the East Side, and that manhole cover figures into it.
Yeah, the story is narrated by a high school girl who's been living in the streets with a few friends of hers. So she's sort of homeless, and she's been given an assignment by one of her teachers to write a letter of appeal or complaint to a politician. And so the story itself is a letter to the mayor of Milwaukee. We shouldn't have been there in the first place. That's the problem with telling you anything real. We should have been tucked into soft little beds, dreaming of algebra or homecoming or whatever. We shouldn't have been creeping through the sewers under your city. I know that much. We shouldn't have been hunched up like rodents, sweeping our flashlights along the damp, scratchy walls, trying not to hit our heads while we searched for those metal rungs that lead up to manholes. Don't worry, I'm not talking about your real sewer system, Mr. Mayor, that deep channel of filth that flows down to Jones Island and fills up Lake Michigan. I'm talking about the old spiderweb of pipes that runs closer to the surface, under the East Side. Maybe you don't even know it exists. but we do. Me, Diego, and JJ, we drop down into it at night because some of those manholes don't open onto streets or alleys like you would expect. They open up into the garages of people like you. And people like you store all kinds of pawnable stuff in your garages, so much that you forget you ever even had it. I bet 9 out of 10 people we hit don't even know they've been robbed. So how bad am I really supposed to feel about it?
Terrific. Well, I want to thank all three of you for coming in this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Hennessy edited the short story collection, Milwaukee Noir. Jennifer Morales and Valerie Lakin are two of the contributors to the collection. Our interview with them first aired last month, and the book is available in stores now. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air comes your way next.